Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, a lot of people take newer drugs that have a side effect of helping them lose weight, but some are also finding it can result in pregnancy. Ozempic babies will have details. We'll also hear from some migrants in Chicago trying to adapt and get on with their lives. A popular bill in the state legislature has again failed to make it to the governor. Advocates for domestic violence survivors say passing what is called Karina's bill would save lives. So why is it having so much trouble? We'll have a report. We'll also hear from a professor making music with cicadas and a boy who suffered severe head trauma at a daycare facility in the state requires round-the-clock care, and his needs are changing. We'll get his story. That and more coming up on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Pearson Eaker was not quite 2 years old when he suffered severe head trauma at a licensed daycare facility in Illinois. A decade later, Pearson requires care 24 hours a day. He's also growing and thriving, and his needs are changing as he nears his teenage years. Jane Carlson has that story.
Like any 12-year-old boy, Pearson Eaker cracks up at certain bodily functions and sometimes rolls his eyes at his parents. He likes fireworks, splash pads, and bumper cars.
Is this the real life?
And he loves Queen.
Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality.
Pearson has a trach and a G2. He communicates with animated facial expressions, huge grins, laughs, and sounds, and through an eye gaze device from his wheelchair.
Do you like your eye gaze, Pearson?
Yeah. This is Pearson's nurse, Stacy Hawkins.
Pearson is awesome. He displays personality and wants and needs every day. He makes choices and he gives facial expressions to say whether or not he cares for whatever it is that's happening.
Hawkins is one of two nurses that care for Pearson and his parents' Monmouth homes.
Your turn. Yay! There you go.
And she's been with the family since Pearson was 6 years old.
Again. Yay!
Pearson's days start with putting on a shaking vest to loosen secretions in his chest, followed by a breathing treatment. He has a pump in his abdomen that helps with muscle rigidity and another in his collarbone that stops him from having seizures. His eye gaze device is called an Accent 1400. It helps him make choices, like what he wants to wear to school that day and what songs he wants to listen to on the way there.
So this has lots of vocabularies or menus to choose from. He can pick letters in his name. These are all of his songs for the mornings. So just for an example, the number songs, he can look at it and then he can tell you which one he wants to hear.
Where's the star at? Or the triangle? Can you find one of those?
Rectangle.
Okay.
Triangle.
Right? Good job.
Triangle.
Good job.
Pearson Eaker is a victim of shaken baby syndrome. When a child is shaken so violently, the brain bounces back and forth inside the skull. There are around 1,300 reported cases of shaken baby syndrome a year in the U.S. One in four victims does not survive. Of those who do survive, 80%, like Pearson, suffer lifelong disabilities. Pearson's mom, Candace, says she and his dad, Tim, made a pact to stay positive.
It's not good to be negative about the situation. We have to make of it what it is. We're pretty positive, and Pearson, you know, is thriving compared to how he could be, because we could have lost him.
But February 14th, 2014 is stamped in their memories. That Valentine's Day, they dropped off toddler Pearson and his infant brother Lincoln at a licensed daycare home in Charleston. Tim got a call just before noon that Pearson wasn't breathing.
Before 2/14/14, Pearson was a walking, rambunctious, talkative, slight attitude, 23-month-old boy. Enjoyed watching Disney movies, enjoyed music prior to as well.
Pearson was rushed to a local hospital and then to a trauma center 60 miles north in Champaign-Urbana in the middle of a terrible snowstorm. Tim says on the way there, he and Candace were sure they'd be coming home by the next day.
It wasn't until the next morning that the team I think it was a neurosurgeon or a neurologist that basically said that Pearson has sustained a traumatic brain injury and that we weren't sure if he was going to come off of life support.
Tim and Candace stayed in hospitals and rehab facilities with Pearson from St. Louis to Chicago for around 200 days after that.
Getting to come home, Pearson was definitely a totally different little boy, but he was breathing on his own.
Tim and Candace and the boys moved to Western Illinois to be closer to Candace's family. The couple later divorced, but lived just a few minutes away from each other in Monmouth. They share parenting responsibilities. They keep the pact to stay positive. And they have an open door policy if either wants to see the kids at each other's houses at any time. Candace says the brothers are very close.
Lincoln's never known Pearson any different than how he is now. They've grown together like this, and Lincoln is just the sweetest to him and plays with him, talks with him, gets him to laugh, and it's a really special bond that they have.
Though Pearson's family remains positive, there have been dark days. The woman charged with shaking Pearson and causing his injuries was found not guilty. Experts testified Pearson's injuries could not have been caused by a fall, like the woman claimed, but a jury found reasonable doubt. And Pearson's family has been left to wonder, what's next, to question why this happened. Why Pearson?
If a child is crying or not doing what you need the child to do, you can just walk away without getting into too many details. Clearly that didn't happen that day.
And through a decade of procedures, surgeries, and hospital stays, Pearson's family didn't always know if he was going to make it home. But Pearson always has.
The last major surgery was spinal fusion, which two rods and 27 screws to keep him straight and upright. And that procedure was done 2 years ago. And since then, he's been making the family room his bedroom.
Here's the situation now. Like other 12-year-old boys, Pearson is growing. He's 5 feet tall and 100 pounds now. He's expected to grow 6 feet tall and reach up to 160 pounds. It's getting harder to pick him up and carry him. At his dad's house, Pearson's wheelchair is too big to make the sharp right turns in a narrow hallway to his bedroom. Tim says it's time to build Pearson the space he needs so he can continue to grow and thrive.
We're currently working with a builder out of Peoria to add on a bedroom, closet, bathroom space just off the current living room.
The new space will have a sleeping area, a therapy area, a bathroom with a tub that Pearson can be lowered into for a long soak. It will also have a ceiling track lift system to transfer him safely, and a door that closes so Pearson the teenager can play his music as loud as he wants.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
The addition to Tim's home will cost $200,000. Some of that has already been raised, and the builder is helping with materials. They have a goal now to raise $100,000 for Pearson's new space.
He's gone through a lot, so we just want to be able to make him as comfortable as possible as we continue on this journey.
For more on Pearson's journey and his current needs, and to help build him his new space, you can visit Pearson Strong for more information. That's PIERSENstrong.org or Pearson Strong on Facebook. I'm Jane Carlson.
Augustana College's prison education program will have its first graduate this year. He's been trying to clear his name. Lexi Woodcock has more.
David Staples will graduate from the Augustana Prison Education Program, also known as APEP. It's a full-time undergraduate program for incarcerated men at the East Moline Correctional Center. The program started in 2021 with a cohort of only 10 students, including Staples. He will now be the first ever APEP student to graduate. Executive Director Sharon Ferralo says the program gives incarcerated men access to the same education as other Augustana students.
Imagine how transformative Augustana is to young people who are, you know, sort of learning who they are. Now, double that, triple that, times 10. It's a portal into another way of being that is not because they're humanly different, but because resources and options become available.
She says Augustana is one of very few colleges in the country to have a program like APEP, and one of even fewer that allows incarcerated students to earn a bachelor's degree in only 4 years.
So we designed an American Studies major that has history, politics, and art, classes from, you know, a lot of different departments. The interdisciplinary nature of it is what's going to make it possible for people to get a degree in 4 years. Most prison education programs, they take 6 or 7 or 8 years.
APEP students can also obtain degrees in other disciplines. Staples will graduate soon with a BA in psychology. Unlike his fellow graduates, he's juggling finals and attending court dates. Staples has been working with the Illinois Innocence Project for years trying to clear his name. Varallo says Staples is, quote, verifiably innocent, yet as of today, his felony charges still stand.
He's been in prison since 1993 for a murder he did not commit, and to this day remains waiting for the state of Illinois to exonerate him.
Varallo says she hopes that he can walk across the stage and accept his diploma as a free man.
Despite all of that has happened to him, he wants to go and study at the master's level, counseling psychology, and do some good for people who have been in situations similar to his.
Staples' case is ongoing. I'm Lexi Woodcock.
The Democratic governor, J.B. Pritzker, signed the new state budget into law this week. He says it's balanced. Dave McKinney has more.
Pritzker's sixth budget since taking office in 2019 authorizes $53.1 billion in state spending. The new budget plan provides more for education and early childhood programs and eliminates the state's tax on groceries. It also has $500 million in seed money for a quantum computing campus that Pritzker says can supercharge state economic growth.
The FY25 budget is another demonstration of the fiscal responsibility that has guided me from day one of my administration.
Senate Minority Leader John Curran called the plan a taxpayer-funded spending spree that prioritizes non-citizens. This is Dave McKinney.
Recently, the term Ozempic baby has been cropping up on social media, from TikTok to Facebook to even Reddit. Some women are saying they are getting unexpected pregnancies while on the medication.
Yes, I was taking semaglutide, which is also known as Ozempic, and I got pregnant.
Yeah, so I'm literally the definition of someone who's having an Ozempic baby.
So I'm almost in my third trimester. Everything's gone.
Welcome to the checkup. I'm Lizzie McGreevy, community engagement specialist at Side Effects Public Media, and our checkup question today is, just what are Ozempic babies? With me to answer this question is managing editor Farah Yousri.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Farah. So like many families, I had the birds and bees conversation with my parents, and they totally left out the part about Ozempic babies. They must have skipped that chapter. So can you please shed some light and tell us what exactly is happening here?
Sure. So, Lizzie, the way Ozempic works is through a process called delayed gastric emptying. So it takes longer for, you know, the food to be absorbed by your body, and that helps people feel fuller for longer. And so they won't reach out to food as often, and that results in weight loss. Now, obesity, diabetes, and insulin resistance are all issues that impact women's fertility and ability to carry a healthy pregnancy. And that's because there are hormones that are stored in the fatty tissue that work against the natural, typical process that helps people get pregnant. So when someone takes Ozempic and addresses these issues, they may find that their fertility struggles have also been resolved, and they find themselves carrying a baby when they did not expect it.
Farah, that makes a lot of sense. But I have also seen posts from women who are taking Ozempic, and they say they got pregnant even though they're on birth control pills. How is that happening?
So birth control pills work in different ways depending on what kind of hormones are in them. So some pills suppress ovulation altogether. Others may make it harder for the sperm to fertilize an egg. And this all depends on if the person takes the pill as directed so that the hormones can do their jobs. Now, Ozempic and the whole delayed gastric emptying process that I talked about can also impact the way medications, including the birth control pill, are absorbed in the body. I spoke with Linda Kassar. She's an associate professor at George Washington University's School of Nursing, and she's worked with OBGYN patients for over 3 decades. Here's how she explains it.
The levels of the hormone aren't going to be consistent, and those conditions that we're trying to set up to prevent pregnancy might actually occur. You know, maybe an egg does get released. Maybe the cervical mucus doesn't thicken the way we expect it to, and maybe the wall of the uterus does get a little thicker. So when the hormones from the pills aren't absorbed in those even concentrations in the way we hope, sets up conditions where pregnancy could happen.
So it sounds like some of these Ozempic babies and pregnancies are happening unexpectedly, which I'm guessing means women may be taking the medication for weeks into the pregnancy. What do we know about the safety of these drugs for the pregnant person and for the fetus?
So lab studies on animals have shown that Ozempic during pregnancy sometimes resulted in pregnancy loss or fetus abnormalities. But it's very hard to ethically design a study where researchers can test the impact of these drugs on the pregnant person and the development of the fetus. So as of now, there really isn't enough safety information available. We also do not know after the pregnancy if, for example, the medication gets passed on through breastfeeding and what kind of impact this has on the newborn. So medical experts advise that if someone is planning to get pregnant and they are on Ozempic, they should be off of it for at least 2 months before trying to conceive. Kassar says it has to be planned out.
You know, not just, oh, I've lost, you know, 35 pounds while I've been taking this medication for my diabetes. I feel healthier now. I'm going to try to get pregnant. There has to be a discussion about what other medication that's doing the job that Ozempic is doing that's been studied a little bit better in human patients. What other thing can we substitute there?
She says there are some other alternatives out there that doctors can talk to you about that could be safer for a pregnant person.
Farah Yousri and Lizzie McGreevy with that episode of The Checkup from Side Effects Public Media. You're listening to Statewide. We've got more to come. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Many migrants in Chicago are getting married, having babies, joining churches, and sending their children to local schools. But that is not the end of their journey. Adriana Cardona-McGigad takes us to two neighborhoods where newly arrived asylum seekers are adapting.
That's a good one.
On a recent afternoon, Luz Marina Niño, an asylum seeker from Venezuela, is celebrating that she just got a new job cleaning at a hospital. This is a huge deal for Niño. She just got a work permit and she doesn't have to go back to the fish market where she peeled shrimp for less than the minimum wage. Niño has been living in a two-bedroom apartment in the integrated Beverly neighborhood with her son Jose and other relatives. Two nuns from the Sisters of Mercy are among Niño's guests, along with Carol Conway. She's a retired English teacher and is Niño's mentor. Conway brought pizza and dessert. These three women have become a network of support for Niño. They are from Catherine's Caring Cause, a nonprofit that helps migrants navigate many aspects of life in Chicago. They found the apartment where Niño has lived. They've also paid for her rent. Before that, Niño stayed at a migrant shelter where she felt unsafe. As her mentor, Conway helped Niño find immigration services and has stepped in when Niño needs to advocate for her son at school.
I mean, I hope Luz feels comfortable asking some question that, you know, and if I don't know the answer, I'll find it because there's a lot of things I don't know, but, you know.
Niño is petite and quiet. She doesn't speak English, and she's getting used to the culture here. Niño says when she's at the store and has to pay, she can't understand the final amount. She shows the cashier her bills, asking, this much? This much? She wonders about her future here. Niño says, okay, yes, they're here, they made it, but what's going to happen tomorrow? Are they going to be able to adapt? Maybe little by little, she says. Now that she's finding stability, her next goal is learning how to speak English. That's a priority for a lot of migrants.
Now, city, todos vivimos in the city of Chicago. Now, county, todos vivimos, I think we live in el condado de Cook.
In Belmont Cregan on Chicago's northwest side, about 5 migrants are registering for English classes at Onward, a community organization that offers education and support services. One of them is Elizabeth, an asylum seeker from Ecuador. She didn't want to give her last name. She worries that her kids will learn to speak English before her, and she won't be able to communicate with them. She's determined to learn. The integration and adjustment process for immigrants is different for everyone, says Andres Albarracín. He's a case manager at Onward. He educates migrants on how to avoid getting in legal trouble, anything from how to drive carefully, follow the rules, and other important topics about relationships, including consent. Elizabeth's son is a first grader at nearby Hanson Park Elementary. She attends parents' meetings and enjoys learning about the education system in Chicago. She's also starting to understand a few more words in English at the fast food restaurant where she works, like the word maybe. At first, she thought people kept referring to a baby. Then she realized it meant perhaps. She says many migrants don't speak the language out of fear of making mistakes, but to her, that's the key to adapting. Adapting also means getting out and making friends, she says. She's found a church and loves taking her kids to the park and grabbing ice cream. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
Illinois lawmakers wrapped up their legislative session last month once again without passing Carina's bill or even calling it for a full vote. That measure would require judges to order the confiscation of guns from people who have emergency restraining orders against them. The bill had bipartisan support, and advocates for domestic violence survivors say it would save lives. So why is this popular, uncontroversial bill still stuck in committee? Mawa Iqbal tried to get some answers.
Monica Alvarez traveled from Chicago to Springfield in April. Speaking at a rally outside of the Capitol building, she said it was both painful and heartbreaking for her to be there.
But I stand here today because my cousin Karina and Daniela were murdered July
3rd, 2023. Karina Gonzalez and her 15-year-old daughter Daniela were shot and killed in their little village home, allegedly by Karina's husband. The court had ordered her husband to stay away from Karina and her family, citing threatening behavior.
An order of protection was not enough.
The murders took place just a few blocks from Democratic State Senator Selena Villanueva's district office. She soon after became the chief Senate sponsor of Karina's bill, a measure aimed at removing guns from those accused of domestic violence.
We've seen stories continuously, and with each and every one of those stories, like, my heart hurts.
Since then, a large network of survivor and gun control groups joined the charge. Even Republicans, like Senate Minority Leader John Curran, are behind the bill.
It is incumbent upon us as policymakers to separate domestic abusers from firearms.
So why did the General Assembly just finish their third legislative session in a row with Karina's bill going nowhere? Villanueva insists the holdup is from law enforcement groups. John Milner is with the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police, and he says they do have some concerns. The bill's requirement that officers have only 4 days after protective order is issued to remove the guns, he says, is too burdensome for smaller departments and could put officers in danger if they don't have enough time or people.
We have to make sure it's done safely, and not just for the police officers, but for the victims of those crimes as well as the neighborhood.
But Milner says their concerns could easily be addressed, and overall, police chiefs like the legislation.
I say we're all on the same side on this. We want to do what we can to prevent any more domestic violence situations from occurring. And if we can find some common ground to make this work, let's do it.
The problem, he says, is that so far he's been invited to just one roundtable meeting with lawmakers, police groups, and bill advocates to hammer out the details.
think there has to be more meetings than just an occasional meeting here and there.
I went back to Villanueva to ask her, if this is a priority, then why hasn't she called more meetings?
That's based on people's schedules. It's not something that I can say. I mean, like, my schedule's also all over the place.
But advocates for domestic violence survivors say there is no time to waste.
The intersection of firearms and domestic violence is well known to be high lethality and high risk.
Manalia Negron is director of policy and research for The Network, an umbrella group of over 40 domestic violence survivor groups. She says deaths from domestic violence shootings in Illinois are on the rise. Negron was standing beside Monica Alvarez at the rally in Springfield last month.
It has been disappointing working on this to see all of the momentum and all of the coalition of support that we received for really the bill not to move forward.
Lawmakers will be back in Springfield for a short legislative session in the fall. Negron says her group is willing to do the work to get Karina's bill across the finish line. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Over the past few school years, the number of Illinois high schoolers graduating with college and career pathway endorsements has grown exponentially. Peter Medlin explains what it is and what they mean for those students.
How do we know a high school student is prepared for their career, whether they're going to college or straight into the workforce? Well, typically it's a high school diploma or a GED, but what about more specifically? How can we say this high school grad's well prepared to pursue a career in computer science or teaching? Well, in Illinois, students can now earn what's called a college and career pathway endorsement. It's a literal stamp on their high school diploma that says by completing a series of steps, they've demonstrated mastery in the area. But what exactly are those steps? Heather Penzak can explain. She's Director of Innovation and Implementations at the Ed Systems Center, housed at Northern Illinois University.
They've engaged in career-focused courses, they've participated in work-based learning, and they've also demonstrated readiness for college-level reading and math.
Students complete internships, team-based courses, and early college credit. And this pathway framework started back in 2016 with the Post-Secondary and Workforce Readiness Act. The State Board of Education developed the system, and school districts built each component part. And finally, in 2020, the first Illinois student earned the seal. And since then, it has been growing fast. In Illinois, 47 students across five districts were awarded in 2021. The class of 22 jumped to almost 600 students in 36 districts, and last year, over 1,000 students in 39 districts. And Penzak expects another leap this year, too. Bryce Shen is one of those students this year. He just graduated from Naperville North High School with an endorsement in business entrepreneurship and is headed to University of California, Berkeley to study business in the fall. With the Pathway program, a few days a month, instead of going to school, Shen got to go into the city. And when he wasn't in class, his friends would naturally ask where he was.
I would tell them I was up in Chicago for my internship, and they'd be very shocked.
The internship was one step towards earning his endorsement, and every Pathway student graduates with at least 60 internship hours. Jill Lovacek is the district's director of innovation and learning.
We actually have six different Pathway endorsements that students can earn.
They have two in agriscience, two information technology pathways, one in business and one in education, and they're planning to add even more next year. It's so ingrained that their course catalog maps out how each class connects to the pathways and even how extracurricular clubs and activities fit in. Lovacek says their process starts pretty early.
So we start those conversations formally through curriculum in sixth grade.
By eighth grade, they want students to start understanding their options and what they're interested in. In eighth grade, that's when they hold what Lovacek calls a career fair on steroids.
We have over 100 business partners attend. Students get to sample the different career cluster areas, and then they come back and talk about what they saw, what they learned, and how does that relate to my next step of high school.
And now you might be thinking, geez, eighth grade, isn't this all a bit too early to lock young students onto a path? Well, they do revisit the plans every year, and Helena Illich says having these work-based opportunities early actually allows for more flexibility and exploration instead of making you feel stuck in a box. She just wrapped up her first year at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and she was part of the first cohort of Naperville students earning their endorsements, hers, in computer science.
solidify that I actually want to do this in a work environment, because I think there's a really big disconnect between like, oh, I like taking a course in this versus I actually like doing this for a job.
She says there's an advantage to finding out early before you're in college and before you spend a lot of money pursuing something you might change your mind about. And Heather Penzack wants to clarify that not every school offers the same endorsements.
Depending what your employer partnerships look like, depending what your college partnerships look like, but also what is the local demand?
Legislation in 2022 expanded the pathway system. Unless they formally opt out, all Illinois high schools will be required to offer an endorsement starting with the class of 2027, who just finished their freshman year this spring. Lavacek says it's also been a great way for her district to strengthen bonds with local businesses, along with colleges and universities.
And it gave us ways to celebrate student success that wasn't just a test score or a grade.
Illick says her opportunities laid a strong foundation for her going into college.
I think a lot of the time college invites a lot of imposter syndrome or like insecurity because it's such a big change. But I kind of had this like solidified, documented thing. I'm like, I can do this because I've done this internship in the past.
And as these programs grow, leaders like Lavacek hope the endorsement signals that this student is well prepared for the next stage of their life. I'm Peter Medlin.
A Midwest organization that uplifts beauty professionals came together recently for a competition to highlight a certain type of barber. Yvonne Booz tells us more.
The Barberess Battle Royale took place at Half Baked Bar in Rockford this past Sunday. Music blared as stylists carefully crafted their creations. Judges stood nearby as others looked on, waiting for the final reveal. This competition puts the spotlight on female barbers. The number of male barbers across the country outweighed the number of females. According to Data USA, the barber industry includes about 79,000 artists, of which 78% are male compared to 22% female. Rebecca Menjarez is the owner of La Jefe's Multicultural Barbershop. This salon hosted the battle. Menjarez has practiced her craft for over 34 years. She says the event includes two lady barber competitions, a hairstylist competition, and a makeup artist competition.
And at the very end, we have a tag team competition. And so the tag team consists of a barber. One of them has to be a female.
Menjarez is a part of a group called Midwest Legends. This organization was started by barbers Marquez Tatum and DJ Mercy Music. It is comprised of about 137 stylists. Tatum is the owner of a Milwaukee, Wisconsin barbershop called Quest Creations. Menjarez also calls him her partner. Tatum says he and DJ Mercy Music created a poster that captures the faces of many Midwest stylists.
And so once we created that poster, then we came up with the Certified Fresh Mixtape Cut Tour, and we started the tour with some of those individuals that was on the poster.
Brandy Brown is the owner of Virtuosity Professional Hair Care Products. She is also a stylist and teacher. She says she received her barber's license years ago, but she set it on a shelf and focused on cosmetology. Things changed when she learned about Midwest Legends.
I think now women barbers are more respected. Women barbers are able to have a clientele without a male sitting in a chair saying, "Can you cut?" So now, you know, we're getting the respect that we deserve because we are just as talented, just as skilled, and just as educated as the male barbers.
Jarquel Parker received his barber's license last year, but he's been cutting for about 2 years. He says women were his inspiration. His first barber was his aunt.
Then I went to school. My instructor was also a woman barber, so the influence has always been there. And just working next to him, you do get a different feel. Like, you can see that they do have a different touch with clients as well. So you get to, you know, pick up on their soft touch skills.
Parker says this event is important because it exposes the professionals to things that they would not have seen standing in a shop. Tyrese Harris says this is his first time attending an event like this.
After this entire show, there was a few barbers I took the time to actually, you know, really appreciate their skill. One was a Tay. Her fading skills was amazing, enough to make me want to grow hair, and I'm bald.
Tatum says this event gives barbers a bigger platform.
It
make our voices louder out here and let barbers know, hey, women barbers are here. Let the world know they're here, they exist.
And for the men asking the ladies, can you cut? This competition shows the answer is, yes, they can. I'm Yvonne Booz.
All right, guys, ready? We're going to count down for 10, all right? Ready? 10.
Making music with cicadas, that story, still on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Western Illinois University is in the market for a new president, but that search won't begin anytime soon, as Rich Egger reports.
Dr. Guiyu Huang stepped down as president at the end of March. Dr. Christy Mindrup, who had been vice president of Quad Cities campus operations, has been serving as interim president. Board of Trustees chairperson Karen Stutz says the search for Huang's successor has been delayed at least through the fall semester and possibly until March of next year. She says Western has exhausted its reserves and must straighten out its finances.
A search at this time distracts from the serious work that must be done now. So temporarily deferring the search is preferable to using scarce resources.
Stutz says the decision should not be interpreted as meaning that Mindrup will lead the university on a permanent basis. However, the board did agree to have Mindrup continue serving as interim president through the end of June next year. Stutz says Mindrup has provided exemplary leadership during her short time in the role.
She took over the job with knowledge and insight embedded in her 27-year history with WIU, which has helped her get to the heart of most of our challenging issues immediately.
Mindrup has already started addressing the financial challenges. In a letter to the campus community, she says Western's annual expenses have exceeded revenues during the past two fiscal years. She implemented an immediate spending freeze and suspended hiring, except for the most critical positions. Rich Egger reporting.
David Rothenberg has a keen interest in how humans and nature can connect in ways some may have never thought of before, specifically through music. A professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, Rothenberg has written books about the musicality behind humpback whales, birds, and even bugs, playing instruments with each species of animal. This month, Rothenberg is visiting Illinois to make music with the emerging cicada broods. And Kimberly Schofield with Illinois Public Media spoke with Rothenberg about his work, including a concert he performed with cicadas in central Illinois.
David, thank you so much for joining me. Have you worked with insects before?
I did a book called Bug Music, which was timed to come out in 2013 mm-hmm. when periodical cicadas came out where I live, in New York State, north of New York City. But the first time I heard them was in Illinois and in Missouri in 2011 when I was working on that book. And here we are. It's 2024. The most number of cicadas I ever experienced was in Lake Springfield, Illinois. And we took these cicadas and brought a few of them into Champaign-Urbana for a concert that night. Five cicadas were put on a microphone. They performed, and the next day we brought them back to the exact same place to make sure they weren't too traumatized.
Do you even have a process of how you approach your interactions with nature when you do these concerts?
Yeah, I'm playing the things that I play. I play wind instruments, clarinets, and flutes. You know, in 2011, I started playing like electronics live. Since then, you know, what's evolved? Now we have like different kinds of speakers you can put in trees, like Bluetooth speakers that can make the sound you're playing right there with the bugs, not quite next to you. And then I'm also going to do more macro filming and photography with these kinds of really super close-up lenses. And unlike just about any other animals in the natural world, where you're carefully trying to film them doing things. There's so many cicadas. You can find whatever you want to film. They're doing it right around you. And you can move them around, pick some up, put them here. They're very cooperative. They don't fly away. They're not scared of you. They have no fear because they outnumber you. So the kind of musicians and performers that work well with this are those, for me, comfortable with improvisation or adjusting their music to playing with these musicians that you can't really talk to.
Yeah.
It's very humbling.
It is. Like you said, they'll outnumber and you just kind of have to go with whatever they're doing. They kind of are like a million conductors to whatever you have.
But they do things that we know. Like there's three species simultaneously that come out. And in some sense, six this year. Wow. But each brood has these three species that have a characteristic, I would say, musical approach to what they do with sound. Like Magicicada septendecim, the most well-recognized one, makes this main sound called the pharaoh sound. Pharaoh, pharaoh. And if you have millions of pharaoh sounds, ooh, 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 many of them, they overlap and you just hear the drone. The tail end disappears if you have millions of them doing it at the same time. It's like an acoustic illusion. So the way they organize themselves is around this steady drone. Okay. The other species, the Magicicada cassini, they make this weird noisy sound like. And if you have millions of them, you'd think it could just be noise like. But they figured out that's a problem. So they do this wave-like quality. They go like. They synchronize themselves, and when they're not singing, they jump up and fly. It's like doing the wave at a football game or something, but they all do this motion together just to get this sound effect that's like a waving rhythm. So they can hear themselves against that drone. Third species, Magicicada septendecula, and they have like a regular, you know, shaker type rhythm. All synchronized together. So you have three basic sounds. It's like I could write this down. I could write a composition called Periodic Cicada. Everyone in the group has to do one of these three things.
What would you say to people who are hesitant to even approach the outdoors because of
sure. this? Or if they say, I'm not going out until the cicadas leave. Exactly. Like, oh my God, yuck. I would just go out and listen to it. They're harmless. They're not going to hurt you. They're not going to destroy your crops. They might eat some leaves on some trees. Those trees are going to survive. They're going to be gone pretty soon, and you're not going to see or hear them for 17 years or 13 years, or if you're at the convergent point for 221 years. Next time you're going to experience something like this, it's an extraordinary wonder of nature. Nature's full of beautiful creatures trying to find a way to survive.
Professor David Rothenberg making music with cicadas. He spoke with Kimberly Schofield. Cicadas have already emerged throughout much of the state, including Chicago's suburbs, but their characteristic buzzing is notably absent in much of Chicago, and experts at the Field Museum say it's likely to stay that way. Here's one Pablo Ramirez-Franco.
You don't see this very often, which is a glass jar full of dead cicadas.
Yes. These were all collected in Evanston on Tuesday by our artist in residence, Peggy McNamara.
That's Jim Louderman. He's an entomologist at the Field Museum. Staring down the cicada packed jar, he says he wants more specimens. So later today, he'll trek out to Oak Park to collect even more red-eyed bugs.
It'll probably take me 20 minutes to collect the last 200 we're going to need.
To get that many cicadas, he has to go to the suburbs. That's because cicada habitat has been so thoroughly disrupted throughout the city. That's according to Hazel Fricke, a longtime volunteer with the insect department at the museum.
We don't have very many old trees in the city, so they won't be able to emerge if they have nowhere to live as nymphs.
These cicada nymphs spend 17 years actively burrowing underground and feeding on the nutritious roots of trees. Louderman says that when those trees disappear, so do the cicadas.
If the trees have been cut down in 100 or so years, which almost every tree in Chicago has been cut down and then replanted, but as soon as the trees that they were originally on die from being cut down, all of the nymphs that are underground then die.
That means that for the most part, Chicago won't be swarming with cicadas. There will be some, but nothing close to the rest of the state, which is experiencing the rare emergence of two different cicada broods, which together include all seven species of periodical cicada in the Americas, each with its own song. But all hope is not lost.
In Chicago, there may be some small pockets, someplace like the Jarvis Migratory Bird Sanctuary up on the north side. They may be there because those are all old trees that have never been disturbed. There is a possibility there could be some there.
To hear the cicadas singing, find your nearest park, look around for the oldest trees, and cross your fingers.
Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco with that report. As the country tries to meet its climate goals, tackling emissions from farming will be key. Agriculture is the fifth largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. One climate-friendly growing technique called biochar involves literally burying carbon in the ground. And as Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke reports, advocates say it's good for crops, too.
Nick Cacchetti is mixing up something special in a bucket on his family farm in Lubering, Missouri.
This is biochar.
Biochar. It's a soil amendment, kind of like compost. And it's a super hot topic in sustainable agriculture. It looks a lot like charcoal. Instead of burning the organic matter, it's cooked at a high temperature with almost no oxygen. As Cacchetti pours the biochar onto vegetable beds, you can hear what makes this substance special. It is extremely hollow and porous. So why is Cacchetti so excited about this stuff?
Pure carbon. You know, you put it in soil, it's just there. You can just forget about it. It's gone.
Biochar is a direct way to sequester carbon, which is driving climate change. But there's a lot more to the climate-friendly practice. Biochar proponents say it creates a sustainable cycle of benefits on farms. For instance, recycling organic waste like corn stalks to make soil healthier and bury carbon. Isabel Lima first got interested in biochar more than 20 years ago, before scientists were even calling it that.
We were trying to address the incredible amounts of waste that agriculture produces.
Lima is a research chemist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and sits on the board of a nonprofit that advocates for biochar. She says indigenous people in the Americas have been using something like biochar for centuries. They would burn agricultural waste and put it back in the soil.
And look very deep in the soil and the Amazon, for example, and we determined that those soils that we would otherwise expect to be very infertile are actually very fertile because of those practices.
Without knowing it, these indigenous farmers were creating a demonstration for modern agricultural scientists. Now, we know biochar makes a really friendly environment for microbes, which can be great for soil and help crops thrive. That's something Scott Boer has seen firsthand. He owns Four Winds Farm with his wife in eastern Iowa. They grow organic hemp, flowers, and herbs. When they first started farming this land in 2020, they had a soil test done.
It was lacking in lots of different areas, so we spent a good bit of money on phosphorus, potassium, nitrogen.
They also applied biochar. Since then, Boer hasn't had to add fertilizer again. He thinks that's because the biochar is holding onto nutrients. Research backs that theory. Less fertilizer is easier on the environment and cheaper. But Boer says the biochar cost benefit takes a while to show up.
If you're in it for the long haul, I think it's a great investment, but it is quite an expense up front.
Cost is one of the biggest hurdles to widespread use, says Miles Gray, program director at the U.S. Biochar Initiative.
It's a relatively small industry. It's growing very quickly. And a lot of that growth is related to the carbon benefits of biochar.
Gray says thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, there are new federal funds to incentivize climate-friendly farming practices, including biochar. But getting farmers into it is still a challenge. Back in Missouri, Cacchetti has experience with this. He used to sell biochar in his first job after college, and knows it has to add up for farmers. As he spreads more biochar out on his farm, he's especially excited that this is a long-term climate solution.
And once you put it in the soil, it's permanent. You can't, go fish it back out.
Experts say this carbon will be locked into the soil for generations.
Pretty quick layer.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Grumke.
This episode of Statewide, and we'll be back again next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find our episodes, they're available where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.